Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, that momentum seems to be going in the wrong way from their standpoint.
Consumers looking for options to a pound of ground beef at $6.99 are finding higher prices for Beyond Beef and Impossible, both over $11. Arlen Suderman with Stonak.
Right now, I certainly, even as high as beef prices are, I just don't see any momentum toward the fake meat, so to speak, at this point. And it seems like during COVID and some of the meat shortages we had at that point, there was a little bit of upward momentum, but a lot of people seem to be figuring out kind of what's in all those products and how they're put together and everything, and shying back away from them once again, particularly at the cost that you have to pay for them.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I had to go back and talk to my dad. I had to go back and talk to family, friends, and a number of our members and multi-generations. You know, this industry is a generational industry.
Carl Ray Polk owns Polk Land and Cattle in East Texas. He's president of the Texas Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association, talking about the New World screwworm.
Of course, we have battled brucellosis, and we have battled hoof and mouth, and we have battled fever ticks recently in South Texas. When you and I spoke last year, this industry was faced with the panhandle wildfires here in Texas. Never in my wildest dreams, Tony, in March of 2024, would I expect to be working with a group of folks that are going to now battle the New World screwworm. It has obviously taken years and years to push that screwworm back into Central America, down into Panama. But what we've experienced since September, October of last year was a continued migration. Now, we were fortunate that what was found in Chiapas, Mexico, in November, we were catching some good weather, and it did mitigate some of the spread. But Tony, the concern is we're going into the battle of the summer, and this little screwworm and these flies, they don't stay behind gates, right? And you don't mitigate this risk by moving cattle out of one paddock or out of one pasture or off of one ranch to another. We are all exposed. We are working very hard to work both with Secretary Rollins. In the state of Texas here. I'm in Austin tonight. I'll be in the Capitol tomorrow. We're working with the Animal Health Commission as well as Texas Parks and Wildlife. But we're doing this in stages. We're not going to defeat the New World screwworm, but we hope to push it back down into Central and South America.
While it could be seen as just a Texas issue or a border issue, Polk warns this is a national issue.
The comment that was a common theme was this is a national security threat. This is a threat to our food chain and beef production. And it's a food security risk. We have been very, an industry that if you look back, Tony, in the last 5, 10, 15 years, we've worked so hard to mitigate any disease, and therefore we're doing a lot more today as far as production with less head of cattle. This New World screwworm, the flies, it could have a gigantic impact. We estimated here in the state of Texas it could impact up to 1.8 billion specifically to cow calf producers in the state, over $750 million. So big risk. We're working and taking a bite at this apple one bite at a time, but it is going to have to take some quick moves, which we're in the process of, I hope, of seeing happen with Mexico now. And then we begin looking at ways in which we can further mitigate this by maybe having a fly facility here in Texas.
Texas cattleman Carl Ray Polk. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I don't think I have to help them understand. I think they understand very well.
While speaking recently at the Institute of International Finance, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on helping leaders in other countries understand.
It's just a matter of impetus and will. So I believe I first went to Japan in 1990, 91, within 12 months of the peak of the bubble, a decade of that unwind, a decade of malaise. And then in 2012, I ran across a fellow, 2011, who was running for prime minister named Shinzo Abe, and he knew that Japan needed change and implemented it very quickly. 10 years later, more than 10 years later, Japan has had a remarkable economic run, and I think that they our Chinese counterparts that will come to this realization, and if some of our policies, sometimes it takes an external push.
Right.
Alternatively, what I have said previously, there is an opportunity for a big deal here, that the U.S. is looking to rebalance to more manufacturing. The identity of that would be less consumption. If China is serious on less dependence on export-led manufacturing growth and a rebalancing toward a domestic economy, I think they use the term dual circulation. Well, it's right now it's really singular circulation. And if they want to rebalance, let's do it together. This is an incredible opportunity. And I think if Bridgewater founder Ray Dalio were to write something, he could call it a beautiful rebalancing.
Speaking to economists, Bessent said, actually, when it comes to the European Union, President Trump helped them more than they could imagine.
It wasn't in a straight line. It wasn't always the way a trained diplomat would have done. But I think we should all congratulate President Trump. He has done what a succession of European leaders have tried to do for the past 26 years, since the advent of the euro, that whether it's the French, the Italians, other European countries have tried to get Germany to increase their fiscal spend and drive the European economy, and that I applaud these nascent efforts because it's a combination. It's a combination of economic stimulus, and it is a combination of burden sharing on the European continent for defense. And you know, as I've said many times before, economic security is national security. National security is economic security. So if this European plan works, that I applaud it. I had a private meeting with the Spanish finance minister last week, 2 weeks ago, and he said, you're going to be pleasantly surprised with where we go on military spending, and that this 2% number today, he was right.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There is just GDP growth in those emerging and developing economies.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain marketing economist, Dr. Mark Welch.
From 1980 to 1999, they grew at an average of 3.5% in that period when GDP growth and really wasn't separated from the advanced world. In this period of globalization and increased activity of trade, there was a greater participation in these markets from supplying products to the global marketplace. Average GDP growth from 2000 to 2019 was 5.5% in those economies. Of course, then we had a reset up and down with the pandemic. And then coming out of that era, current projections prior to the turmoil that we're entering into today, which if we do see an imposition of tariffs and restrictions of trade, that number is not going to go up. If economic theory is right about anything, if it's correct at all, that will have a depressing impact, a negative impact on economic growth, U.S. and globally. But the current projection were in October was for 3.8% growth moving forward. Why does that matter? When you look at grain consumption, think of these three periods from this period of advanced economies, globalization, and what's happening in the post-pandemic. I'm going to show you a chart of world per capita grain consumption in those three periods. It looked like that. That's world per capita consumption of food grains and feed grains. So rice is in there, wheat is in there, corn, sorghum, and these other more minor feed and just great food grains in there as well. From 1980 through 1999, actually, that number was coming down. We were consuming less per person. Now, global consumption is still going up. There's more of us. But on a per capita basis, that was a negative trend in world per capita grain consumption. But look what happened when those economies began to grow at a level that was expanding the middle class, expanding the level of disposable income in those economies. We saw a surge in world per capita grain consumption. Part of that biofuel, yeah, it plays a piece. But that started in 2000, well before the impact of the renewable fuel standard and really energy policies that incorporated particularly grain for fuel. Several years prior to that, and continued as that industry is really maturing in many ways. And it's early, but it does appear that post-pandemic, now we're seeing a significant change in that trend. And that, I think, will be tied and correlated, at least to some degree, to prospects for economic growth. And so if we're seeing factors that would impede or slow down economic growth, particularly in that part of the world, in those global and emerging economies, economic factors that hinder that growth of particularly in disposable income, spending money for things like grains and for other products for feed and food and fuel, and throw in fiber. I think that will have a significant impact on our economies moving forward. So again, it's early. But the implication of that being, we're still going to have droughts. We're going to have other issues that are going to cause tremendous volatility and variability in prices. But if we're entering more in this kind of world with flatter economic growth and flatter projections for growth and per capita, I think it's still going to grow, but flatter growth projections for per capita grain consumption, what that means is when we have good crop years, we're going to have much greater capacity for supply to keep up with demand. In fact, for supply to exceed demand, perhaps for longer periods of time, and that's not positive for the price impact of those particular patterns and trends. So, yeah, there's still going to be things are going to happen.
This is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Big, beautiful bill, as I call it, our big, beautiful bill.
At a White House event on Wednesday, President Trump speaking to business leaders.
We may name it that, actually. We'll include 100% expensing retroactive to January 20th. So that's all the way back to just about the beginning of the year. So expensing 1 year, you take a deduction 1 year so you can build your factories right now, essentially almost tax-free if you think about it. Nobody's ever been given that. And we're going to make that expensing for a four-year period at a full 100%. So last time we made it 1 year and you had the deductions you'd do from 100% to 80 to 60 to 40 to 20 to Zippo. And now what we're going to do is we're going to keep it at that level, and we're going to have it for 4 years. So I believe that was one of the reasons that we had such unbelievable growth. Also, we allowed you to bring money back from outside of the country. It was impossible. You had to have 15 different law firms representing you. It was so complicated. And worse was that the tax rate was 65%. I lowered the rate substantially, but still a lot. You know, we shouldn't take your money just to hold you hostage, right? So we lowered it to a reasonable amount, and we took in trillions of dollars, came back. Apple brought in a tremendous amount of money. A lot of the companies here brought in a lot of money, and the businesses represented today clearly understand that if you build your factory in the United States, your tariff rate is zero, and you have other advantages too, and not the least of which is what I just said having to do with the bill. Now, we have to get that bill approved, so call your local representative, please, and make sure that we get it approved, because I don't want to talk too early, but we're doing well with the Republican Congress. We have the Senate is doing great and the House is doing great. John Thune has been spectacular. Mike Johnson has been, Speaker, has been spectacular. I don't think we'll have any Democrat votes. If we don't get it passed, what would happen is your taxes go up 68%. Think of that. And we may not get one vote because they just vote against. It's Trump derangement syndrome, or maybe it's just they hate Republicans, or they hate what we're doing because they've lost their confidence. They've totally lost their confidence. They don't know what the hell is going on. And we are going to get it done. It's probably going to be fully Republican. Fortunately, we have the House. We have the Senate. And we may or may not have a couple of grandstanders. I don't know. But if we do, it would be good if you could work on anybody. I mean, if I were a Democrat, I'd be voting for it 100%. Because I think it's very dangerous politically not to vote for. Think of it, your taxes go up almost 68%. So, but it looks like we're in good shape, I think. And hopefully we'll get it approved. It'll be the biggest bill ever approved in the history of our country. And it'll be the biggest tax cut ever approved in the history of our country. And in addition to that, regulations, which I'm doing in and outside of the bill, will be as big or bigger than we did last time. We have the record for regulation cuts in the 4 years. We cut four times higher than any other president in a four-year period. And we're talking about eight years and two-term presidents. We were four times higher than any other president in terms of regulation cuts. And I went to a friend of mine who happens to be in the room, one of the biggest business leaders. I won't mention him because I don't know. Maybe he'll like it. Maybe he won't. I said to him, so if you had your choice between the big tax cut last time and the big regulation cuts, which were the biggest, again, the biggest we've ever done, I would have said taxes, but he would have said regulation. I said, which was more important to you? Then he said, if I could only have one, yeah, if you could only have one, he said, most important would have been regulation. The regulation was more important than the tax cut.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I most recently updated these feedlot return projections. They're dated April 24, so later last week.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is a Kansas State livestock economist on feedlot returns.
As your listeners probably remember, all these are posted to agmanager.info. You and I are not going to read every number that's in these. I think there's seven tables, or one table and six figures every month we put this out. But to your point, the general trend would be positive margins are expected for cattle leaving Kansas feed yards for most of 2025. And I'll just call out a couple specific ones. You know, we're about ready to turn into May. Steers leaving the yard in May are projected to have a positive return of $359. What's underneath that is a cost of gain that broke $100. So some improvement. Cost of gain went down on those projections. Fed futures at 208 with a positive basis gives us a 213 projected sales price. So the sales prices are inching up while the cost of gain is coming down is the main reason for that elevated, you know, that break of $300 positive margin that's expected. The parallel number for heifers is 308. So it's trailing steers a little bit, which isn't uncommon, but still north of $300. So it's a positive margin. I will interject here. Those that regularly use this know this, but this is a unhedged example. So if you didn't hedge the cattle before you bought them, you didn't hedge them before you sold them, and you didn't hedge your grain, this is sort of what we're mimicking. In reality, a lot of feed yards at least partially hedge one, if not multiple of those legs. And those that are partially or fully hedging are going to experience much lower highs and much higher lows than we have here in this unhedged example. So not everybody's going to get a positive $300 return is the point. But those that did have a good experience and remained open to the market look like they're going to have some very good returns the next few months based upon what the market's currently projecting.
Says when it comes to these feedlot returns, the runway is getting short.
So when we get to October, these positives turn negative. And even before that, when we get to like September, they are cut in half, so to speak. And the main reason for that is Fed cattle prices are sort of similar to what they are in March, you know, the projections, but those cost of gains return. So it's costing more to put pounds on. And the biggest difference is there's $30 to $35 per hundredweight more on the animals coming in. So the feeders coming in that leave the yard the end of 2025 are in the yard at a much higher price. So your inputs are just more expensive from the get-go. And if you don't have ongoing improvement in either cheaper cost of gain or higher sales price when the cattle leave the yard, that's going to pull down your margins. And that's what's baked into these projections. So very good Q2 and Q3 to put a bow on this as projected, and negative returns by Q4 is what we put out last week.
He also is the chief author for the Meat Demand Monitor when it comes to export demand.
So to be clear here, export demand would be, you know, the demand of foreign buyers. So Japan, China, Mexico, Canada, you know, they're all major buyers of U.S. meat items. And this is putting a bow around that collective group. So not domestic, but all foreign buyers. Foreign demand for U.S. beef was down 4.5% in February compared to February of 24. Pork was down almost 3%, and chicken was down marginally. I mean, my notes here basically flat. That's very consistent with my sort of words of caution and concern on the domestic front is, you know, there's been lots of international trade discussion. Tariffs are up for debate, and, you know, they're higher than they were for sure, and up for debate how long they're going to last and what levels. And that very likely is going to reduce international trade in aggregate, and not surprisingly have this effect of reducing export demand for U.S. meat.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is a Kansas State livestock economist, and this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We could be entering into a period of time, and it would seem to be indicating that if growth is slowing, population growth is slowing, that we're creating an environment that, again, with favorable weather, increased production, we're more likely to be able to keep up with that rate of growth of demand. And that could have an overall dampening effect for our commodity prices in general moving forward for the next, you know, several years, given this kind of outlook.
That's part of the outlook, says Dr. Mark Welch, Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain marketing economist. The other?
Our weather outlook, we're leaving this La Nina behind. We've left the bottom point of a very shallow La Nina, very short-lived La Nina. But the forecast from here on out this spring is back in the neutral zone, such that our weather patterns will be driven by some other things, but not under the influence directly as we've seen under the dry and warm La Nina, not getting back to a wet and cool El Nino at this point. But again, something a little more normal, which hopefully will be more favorable to us in the southern plains. So the wheat balance sheet. And again, there's the Outlook Conference of 25-26. Then plug in a prospective plantings number where we had a wheat number that's the second lowest since 1919. Big drop in wheat acres. Winter wheat acres held up okay at spring wheat. We saw a big reduction in spring wheat acres, which lowered us from a 47 million acres planted to 45.4. Leave in USDA's yield at this point. I'm not going to play with that. I think we're probably going to be high. But leaving that for the time being, instead of seeing a 1% increase in supply at the Outlook Conference, now we've got a 1% decrease in supply. Expectations of use, very little change from the 24 wheat crop. So if you're decreasing supply and holding use steady, that's going to tighten up that supply situation. If we see a 4 to 5% increase in price based on that 1% change in supply, we could be looking at wheat prices. Again, this is the season average farm price. From $5.50 a year ago, I think we could be back around this $5.50, maybe even to $6 wheat by the time this marketing year plays out, if we're trading fundamentals. Again, how much of that's just thrown out the window in this environment? I think that's the real key of trying to understanding where we're going. The seasonal index of wheat, usually there's some marketing opportunities as you get into February, March, April, May, before a big break in the fall. We may yet have one of these in us in the wheat market. If it stays dry, we get a threat of a freeze in Kansas or southern Russia like we had a year ago. Again, holding this level at 560, I think is very important for a price movement moving forward and perhaps setting the stage for maybe some upward price movement before we get to harvest of this crop. But again, the U.S. condition looks it's going to be tough, and then look at some key conditions around the world. So that's what I brought to share. I think we are looking at high input costs, obviously, tight margins if the weather is good. The global grain situation is relatively tight, where you're looking at wheat or corn. So I'm looking at lower prices for corn, maybe a little bit higher for wheat. Weather, of course, the primary driver. But I think this image is really important for 2025. That statue sits outside the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C. I'd love to see this. I've never seen it in person. It was commissioned in the 1930s by the Roosevelt administration, and it demonstrates the impact of trade on the economy. In fact, the statue is called Man Controlling Trade. And I think it indicates that trade is a beast, but it can be a partner. It can be one that you can use to productive purposes, or it can be a force that if you misuse it or abuse it, that thing will hurt you. And so I think how we manage all that and unfolding for the U.S. economy, the global impacts of that, I think will be very, very important, how we manage the potential and prospects of trade in this upcoming crop year is going to be really, really critical for price determination.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Eradication efforts are underway against the invasive pest Asian longhorn beetle found in four states. The Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service works with other USDA agencies and state organizations to develop annual control and eradication plans. Catherine Brodsky of USDA APHIS says such plans follow a similar development path.
We conduct surveys to limit the scope of the infestation, really trying to find out how far has the beetle spread to trees in an area. And once we do that, we have established a quarantine area that helps to regulate the movement of wood products and other hosts that could potentially spread Asian longhorn beetle to new areas. Really do education with the community to let them know why they can't move firewood from their backyard or other things outside of the quarantine area.
With quarantines lifted after several conducted surveys and removal of all infested trees within an area, I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.